All right. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Well, I don't know about you, but I am so thankful to be here doing this today and celebrating God's holy Sabbath rather than thinking about Halloween. You know, it's October 31st. What a stark contrast, right? I mean, here we are, you know, a day to draw close to God, to fellowship with Him and commune with Him. And, you know, versus a day that's all about these dark forces. You know, it's, you know, when you think about the deception, really, that the mainstream church has with regard to these ancient pagan festivals and having refashioned them into something supposedly, you know, Christian and holy, in order to try to worship the true God with it. You know, you can see how at least Christmas and Easter have this at least thinly veiled, thing on the surface. You could believe that if you didn't do much research. But, you know, Halloween, I don't know. I don't get it. I just never have gotten it. It's just openly, blatantly, on the surface, unashamedly pagan and evil. And yet we have Christians that engage in this. And I don't understand it. I guess I just don't want to understand it because it's the easiest one to unravel and run from, not just walk from, but run from. I mean, how do you engage in and read all about spiritual warfare and then say, oh, well, we're going to celebrate this, the holiday of the enemy? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, even I can even remember back when I didn't really know much about, you know, when I was a early Christian and didn't know anything about some of the things that we know about. Even then, to me, you know, Halloween was a puzzle. It's just creepy. You know, why are we doing this? So, anyway, I don't get it, you know, at all. So, I suppose I could have suspended our little series today and spoken about Halloween and done the old meat and due season thing, but I've done it before. If you're curious about what I've said about it in the past, there's a message called All Hallows Eve. It was back in October of 2013. So, at any rate, we're going to ignore that. We're going to move right along and dive in. Yeah, amen. And dive back into our series, Genesis chapter 7. These are the words of our God that we're going to focus on today. It says, "The Lord said to Noah, 'Come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. You shall take with you seven of each of every clean animal, a male and a female, two each of animals that are unclean, a male and a female. Also seven each of the birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of the earth.'" That's the purpose, to keep the species alive on the face of the earth. "For after seven more days, I will cause it to rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made." Wow, we get quite a few details here about the flood. We really don't get another direct quote about from God in the Bible until about halfway through the next chapter. So what do we get from this? Remember, these are God's words directly, right? So there's no messing around with, you know, well, this is commentary and whatever. These are God's words. So we see here that it was not only Noah that was pure, like we talked about last week, but also his household. So the whole household went in. We also understand from this that we get support early on for the idea of clean and unclean animals. And we know that this was not a Sinai, old covenant thing. Indeed, some animals were created as consumables for humans as food, right? Food. Some were not. You can eat arsenic if you want to. A little bit of it ain't gonna kill you, but it'll build up. It's poison. It's poison over time, right? But it's not food, right? So it's the same with the unclean animals. It's poison. It's slow poison. Now, there's a lot of foods that you can eat, and I'm not going to dwell on this, but just mentioning it because it's applicable here. There's a lot of food that you can eat, and you can eat out of balance, and it's not good for you. But at least it's food, okay, right? God says these other animals, they're not food. They're not fit for human consumption, period. Now, I can stand here and say that because, why? Because God said it. All I'm just doing is saying what he said. God, the creator of the universe, of everything on this planet that made food, said, this is not food. Period. I don't think you have to do much more. I could do another message about that. I've done it before, just like Halloween. But what I haven't covered before, I've never done this, is really looking at this flood story that continues from here, like I said, through about halfway or a little bit more than that through the next chapter. I'm going to pick up there next week in chapter 8 where they are leaving the ark and God speaks again. But for today, I want to talk about what happens next. I want to talk about, in between there, I want to talk about this flood. And so I want to read the account here to start with today. Noah did according to all the Lord commanded him. Noah was 600 years old when the flood waters were on the earth. So Noah with his sons, his wife, and his sons' wives went into the ark because of the waters of the flood. Of clean animals, of animals that are unclean, of birds and everything that creeps on the earth. Two by two they went into the ark to Noah, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. And it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were on the earth. You want to be picking up clues here as we go through. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, in the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep were broken up. And the windows of heaven were opened. The Shamayim, we're going to talk about that. And the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. And on the very same day, Noah and Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with them entered the ark. They and every beast after its kind, all cattle after their kind, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind, and every bird after its kind, every bird of every sort. And they went into the ark to Noah, two by two, of all flesh in which is the breath of life. So those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in and as God commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. The Lord shut him in. The ark was sealed from the outside. Okay. Now the flood was on the earth 40 days. The waters increased and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and greatly increased on the earth, and the ark moved about on the surface of the waters. And the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. There's a big clue there. All the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. And all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, all that was on the dry land died. So he destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle, creeping thing, and bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. And the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. Okay. Chapter 8. Then God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were also stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. And the waters receded continually from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the waters decreased. Then the ark rested in the seventh month, the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat. And the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. So it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. Then he sent out a raven which kept going to and fro until the waters had dried up from the earth. He also sent out from himself a dove to see if the waters had receded from the face of the ground. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot, and she returned to the ark to him, for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her, and drew her into the ark to himself. And he waited yet another 7 days, and again he sent the dove out from the ark. Then the dove came to him in the evening, and behold, a freshly plucked olive leaf was in her mouth, and Noah knew that the waters had receded from the earth. So he waited yet another 7 days and sent out the dove, which did not return again to him any more. And it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, that the waters were dried up from the earth, and Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and indeed the surface of the ground was dry. And in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dried. Right after this, God speaks again. We'll pick that up next week. They're going to leave the ark. And we're going to talk about the covenant and everything that he made with Noah. We'll do that next time. For now, though, we just read a lot of details about this flood. We're not left in the dark, on a lot of this stuff. It was quite an amazing event when you think about it. It was a one-time world-changing event. So what exactly is the Bible revealing here that occurred? I want to kind of walk through this. First of all air-breathing land animals were killed, weren't they? Everything was wiped out. The entire population of air-breathing land animals died, except those that were taken into the ark. So what we're doing is we're looking at what did this text tell us? What are the facts that this text tells us? Okay. We get that from Genesis 7:21, which we read. All that was on the dry land died. That's what it said. Now, furthermore, last week in chapter 6, we read this, that behold, this is what he said he's going to do, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth. Why? What was his purpose? To destroy from under heaven all flesh, which is the breath of life, everything that is on the earth shall die. Okay, so that was his purpose. Now, why is this important? Well, there's a lot of people out there that will tell you and teach that the flood was a local event. It was a local event, that it was not a global, globe-encompassing flood. Rather, they say it only happened in the area around Mesopotamia. It was a local Mesopotamian flood. But the Bible reveals here that it was all flesh under heaven. Is that not what it says? Okay, when we look at this word heaven, the word is Shamayim. And if you study into that word, you'll find that it is the atmosphere. That it is the atmosphere. You know, there's three heavens in the Bible. This particular one is the atmosphere around the globe. And so if you have something that happens under the everything under the Shemayim, and the Shemayim is covering the whole globe, what does that tell you? Okay? It's the atmosphere. There wasn't just Shemayim over Mesopotamia. The Shemayim goes all around the globe. And so even apart from that, I want to be critical about this a little bit. Let's just think for a moment about this theory and everything that we just read. God had Noah construct an ark. You know, it took him over 100 years to make this thing. It was a monumental task. Now, I want to ask you, if the flood was only local, in just the area of Mesopotamia, like some people will tell you, why in the world would you need to take one pair, male and female, of every species, every animal, and save it from a local flood? It makes no sense. I mean, apply this to our current land masses. Let's say that there's a localized flood and it covers all of Australia. Wipes everything out in Australia. Do you need an ark to build and save the animals? Aren't there animals on the African continent, this continent, every other continent? Why do you need to save the animals, you know, if a whole continent is wiped out with a local flood? God would not need to save the animals because they would exist in other places. It makes no sense. They could reproduce from there and then repopulate that other continent. If only those animals in a specific geographic location died, it would seem completely unnecessary, would it not, for God to bring pairs of every animal in? And what did he say? Why did he say he did it? so that they would not perish, that they would be able to be replenished, that there would be representatives of every kind in other areas. Okay, another point. If the flood was localized, even a gigantic area again, think about it. God had the animals come to the ark. We read that last week, right? Noah didn't have to go fetch them. God had them come to the ark. Now, if it's local, if God can make those animals come to the ark, and he's going to bring a flood and he's going to bring it local, wouldn't it be a lot easier and make a whole lot more sense for him just to say, okay, you two, you need to go here where it's going to be dry? Right? You didn't need to build an ark, send them to an ark. Just send them to another place where it's going to be dry. And the flood happens, the waters recede, they're still around. It doesn't make any sense. For a localized flood, it makes no sense to have an ark. Because if he wanted to just save Noah, if this was a thing where this was Noah and he was righteous and this is my servant and I'm going to bring a flood, but I want to save this family, what do? You build a boat. You tell him, okay, you better build a boat and you better put enough supplies on it to last for a year, because I'm going to send a flood and it's too far away for you to go, so get at it. Well, it took him a year to build the ark, didn't it? Over a year. How far could he have traveled in that year to get away from where the flood was going to be? It just logic, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. You don't need an ark unless the flood is global. Which brings me to the next point. The ark was big enough to hold all the animals. And guys, this is a point of contention between both believers and and unbelievers, scholars, they would maintain that a ship capable of doing this would be of monumental size, well beyond the dimensions given in the Bible. They also cast doubt. They cast doubt about Noah's ability to even build the vessel. You realize that? They act like people back then, because they have this idea of evolution. They think they were cavemen or something, and they think they're idiots. Well, they moved stones, they build the pyramids, and they move stones that, you know, today there's not a construction company on this planet that can move those stones. Who's the idiots? They knew things we didn't know. They did things we can't do today. So who's the idiots? Now, the scoffers, guys, I've been reading. I had a real time with this. The scoffers will then start citing the tremendous numbers of species that are on the earth. Hundreds of thousands of separate species of animals that they say would need a representative pair to be put on the earth. But that argument does not hold water, because biblical kinds appear to be distinct breeding groups, okay? You don't need every single scientific species on the ark. You have multiple interbreeding species can come from the same kind. We get this with the example of dogs. It's cited all the time, and it's a good one. You know, because from one kind of pure line of dogs, you get all the little yappy dogs to the, you know, St. Bernards and wolves and everything, all from just that one kind, the dog kind. And so when you consider the numbers, also, this gigantic number that they cite, the vast majority of land-based animals are insects. And how much room do you need for that? I have it written down in here. I don't remember now. A few square inches per each. You know, it doesn't take any space. And even with the other animals, Judy and I were talking about this during our fellowship time.
1:30 to 2:30.
1:30 to 2:00. Oh. That you don't. Gosh, come on, Grandma. You. You know, do you send this God in his infinite wisdom that has a boat that's a certain size, and he's telling the animals to come to the ark, does he send grown ones? I don't think so. I can't prove that, but, you know, makes sense to me. I think he's smarter than I am. Babies take up a lot less space. In fact, it's estimated on the aggregate, if you look at all, I mean, of course, some are going to take more than others, but on the average, the space that you need per animal on the ark is about 1.5 feet cubic amount of space. It's not a lot. Many studies have shown that the ark, with the dimensions given in the Bible, was indeed big enough to hold the quantity of animals that would be necessary to accomplish God's plan and replenish the earth. You know, there's even ample space left for Noah and his family to have room for living quarters and supplies and that sort of thing. There are theories even that God commanded the animals to sleep, to slow down their metabolism. That was interesting. If you've ever watched that movie, Russell Crowe, I think it was Russell Crowe that did the movie about the ark. They never said anything about it, but he was always, Noah was always making this fire and this smoke that would go out with these special ingredients, and that was keeping the animals asleep on the ark. I thought it was interesting. But we'll have to wait, you know, to ask God about that. It's just a theory. I think it'd be pretty smart. All right, the point is the ark was big enough. It was big enough to hold all the animals and to do the job. All the animals not on the ark were killed, and the ark was big enough to save the rest. Also, all humans were killed. Humans are, after all, land animals, are we not? Recall what we just read, Genesis 7:21. All flesh died that moved on the earth, birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, and every man. It's very clear about this, okay? I highlight this because it speaks again to this global nature of the flood. Now think about it. The Bible says here that all humans were destroyed. Now, at this point in history, we're about 1,600 years in. Okay? So, rough numbers. So that's 1,600 years of human reproduction on the earth. The estimates range from hundreds of millions of people to even maybe a billion or more. Okay, there's a lot of people on the earth at this time. Now, when you consider the fact that urbanization wasn't, you know, what we have today. You know, this idea of everybody piling into very large cities and urban areas is a kind of a modern thing. You know, back then there was a lot more farmers and shepherds and that type of thing. So the people were spread out. We also get this clue, we read it last week, that at this time the people were very violent. You know, they were evil. And so when that starts to happen, people also have to begin to separate, put space in between themselves for protection, right? And so, you know, the people were spread out. They certainly, you cannot, if every man was killed and we have hundreds of millions of people, maybe even a billion or more, were they all in the area of Mesopotamia? No, not feasible. It's not feasible. It was not a local flood. So the Bible is telling us this next point, that the humans had populated the entire world. Not the entire known world. Okay? Not just Mesopotamia. That large amount of population couldn't have existed just there. It would have been much too small. And like I said, it was very spread out, and it couldn't have been a localized flood to kill every human that would have been on the earth after 1,600 years. Okay, there's another indication in this text against the hypothesis of it being a local flood. And that's the fact that they were in the ark about a year. That's a long time. They weren't in that ark for just while it was raining for 40 days. We read that the depths were opened up and the rain came for that time. But then they were in the ark for much longer, waiting for all of this water to recede. Now, if you think about it critically, if it was a localized flood, 53 weeks is an absurdly long time for that water to recede, for it to be a local event. Common sense would even tell you that there would be some dry land. Even at the height of this thing, there would be dry land at the horizon, maybe. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, even after that, even after the flood, the water stopped, it was 4 months. And the dove still couldn't find a place to rest and had to come back after 4 months. And now, and that's a pretty neat detail right there. That's telling us something that just does not fit the circumstances of a local flood. Because if it was local, that dove could have flown somewhere to where it was dry, but it could not find dry land at all. So Now, when you apply that into a global flood, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Given that it was a global event. So, to me, this text is clearly revealing a global event. It also reveals the scope of that event. The water rose high enough that all the mountains were covered. All right, recall Genesis, what we just read. The waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole Shemaim were covered. It says that the waters prevailed 15 cubits upward above those mountains. You know, a cubit was here to here, okay? So it's about 20 feet, right? So the tops of all the mountains under the Shemaim were covered. Now the Shemaim encompasses the whole globe. So everything under the Shemaim was covered with at least 20 feet of water. Every mountain, not just the hills around Mesopotamia, which some will tell you. It says all the high hills under the Shemaim. That's a lot of water. That's a lot of water. No wonder it took that long to recede, to go away, to do whatever. It took months and months for this to happen. And so what we learn is this is not an ordinary flood. It was a cataclysm. And it's supported by the language in the Bible. When you look at the Hebrew and the Greek, both languages use a unique word when describing the flood. It doesn't use the word for flood. Okay? In the Hebrew, it's Mabul, M-A-B-B-O-O-L. No clue if I'm pronouncing it right. But in the Greek, it's Kataklysmos. It's exactly where we get our English word cataclysm. Kataklysmos. Guys, this was no ordinary flood. It was not referred to as just a flood, okay? And so, because of that, the result is that the whole earth was devastated. Clearly, God said he was going to destroy the earth. Read what we read last week. God said to Noah, you know, I am surely going to destroy both them, he was referring to the evil and everything that had gone on the earth. He was going to destroy them and the earth. Now, this is what you need to know. This word earth, it's translated from the Hebrew E-R-T-Z. Okay? And it can also be translated land. And the local flood people will be very quick to remind you of that. That, oh, this just meant the land. They were just referring to the land. They weren't referring to the globe, right? They were just referring to this land of this local flood. But we read that land, even if you translate it land, he said it was all the land under the Shemaim. Well, the Shemaim, I keep saying it goes all the way around the globe. So whether you say the land under the Shemaim or the earth under the Shemaim, it's still referring to the same exact area, mass of the surface of the earth. Either way, doesn't matter. It does if you don't recognize that God is saying under the heavens. And know that what that's talking about. The global event of of this flood is referred to more than 30 times in Genesis, in chapters 6 through 9. You know, Isaiah 54, verse 9, says that, I swore that the waters of Noah would never again cover the earth. Cover the earth. That's what Isaiah said. And Peter said this, referring to the flood, He said, by which the world that then existed perished. The world being flooded with water, but the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and the perdition of ungodly men. What's that saying? Peter is giving a very clear warning, a global warning. Warning, not global warming. Global warning. You know, that God created the earth, he devastated it by flood, and then he's saying, and one day he's going to do the same thing and devastate it with fire. So you got to ask yourself, is Peter saying that the fire is only going to happen in Mesopotamia? That the destruction that's coming next is only going to be localized? No, Peter is completely referring to a global flood of judgment and a global fire of judgment. Okay? Both are global. Just as a flood was global, so will the final judgment of fire be global. So that's my attempt at taking that long text and kind of pulling out some facts, okay? It's kind of a rundown of the biblical narrative here. I have spent, time this week reading various articles, trying to decide how I was going to approach this message today. Guys, the volumes that have been written on this are really quite amazing. And what struck me was they're not just written by believers trying to prove this, but there seems to be this vehement desire by scientists that we just got to disprove this. We just have to. They just have a real interest in debunking this. And it strikes me because they see these pesky little things that they can't quite get their minds wrapped around because they don't fit their anti-God, anti-creator narrative, their mindset. There's these pesky little details that they see, and they're like, it bothers them. It goes against their religion. Okay? Don't tell me that scientists don't have religion. They got a religion. Okay? And some of these things just really bang up against that. And they don't like it. And so why else would they spend so much time, so much energy, in some cases, millions of dollars, trying to make this... Well, one way they try to do it is they say that it's just a retelling of two different flood stories that existed anciently, and the Israelites, when they put their Bible together, they just combined these two stories to come up with what we just read. One of the things they point to, I kind of laughed about this, is that the Bible talks about 40 days and 40 nights, right, that it rained. Well, that's one flood. That was one of the stories, that the flood lasted 40 days. And then when it gets into how long, Noah was on the ark and all of that, and it was a longer period of time, well, that was another story. And so, we just put them together, right? And they know this, of course, because they're smarter than we are. Did you guys read here that it rained for 40 days? And then the rain stopped for... It rained for 40 days. It doesn't mean that he got off the ark and that flood story was over. No, it rained for 40 days, and then he had to wait for the water. So, yeah, there's two different time periods in there, but it's not two different floods, right? Okay. So anyway, I think all you have to do is just read the text and realize it rained, and the other one was just how long they were in the ark. Another article I read, let me just try to speed this up a little bit. Okay, this one's interesting. This fig tree. This guy went to a whole bunch of trouble because he read about the dove. And the point here was to show that if all of the land around the earth was covered in water, that all of the plant life would have died, right? How long can an olive tree stay under the water and still be alive? Well, he did an experiment. He took a fig tree, he put it underwater for salt water for 3 months, and there's the result. It says kills the tree. Now I'm going to quote him. The article concluded this way, quote, "On that basis, when a dove brought an olive twig to the fresh leaves to Noah on the ark, Genesis 8:11, the whole world cannot have been submerged underwater during the flood. Otherwise, all olive trees would have been killed in that 6 months of their submergence under the floodwaters. Therefore, the flood must have been local in southern Mesopotamia, with some land, say 100 feet above water, was present on which olive trees must have been growing, and from which an olive tree with such a twig with fresh leaves could have been obtained by the dove," end quote. So what do you do with that? How's that strike you? How would you respond to that? I sat in my chair and I almost laughed out loud. I was certainly laughing inside. Because the fact is, the plants were regenerating as the water was receding. Obviously. Right? Obviously. And so then I just thought about the ultimate hypocrisy in this. Think about it a minute. Because it goes against their religion. They can have their religion, but we can't have ours. Because I'm going to ask you a question. Isn't it kind of funny that probably this scientist, this guy that conducted this experiment, will sit and tell you that every plant on this whole entire earth evolved out of nothing. But he can't believe that it regenerated out of something. How's that for selective logic? Another article I found by a scientist. This was dry reading, but I got through the whole thing. He gave 24, I couldn't help it. I couldn't help but read it. The title was 24 Reasons Why the Flood, Why It's Impossible for the Flood to Happen. 24 reasons. I'm like, okay, well maybe there's one good one in there somewhere. The beginning statement of the article explained his purpose for writing it, and I have to quote this too. Quote, "I realize that readers of Skeptical Inquirer," that's his blog or his website, "I realize that readers of Skeptical Inquirer accept modern scientific views on this subject. But this examination of the creationist claims might be useful when communicating with others less imbued with scientific thinking." I was like, oh my goodness, did he just call out the entire Christian community and tell us we're idiots? I had to read it. I had to read it. One of his proofs was this one. He quoted, that's actually how I found this one, is because he quoted this research and then I went and read this article. You know how that goes, you get, okay. As I was going through this, as I read each one of them, I was struck by something that I've known for a long time. It's a common theme, and one, it's an error that they have in their reasoning that I see in a lot of science, okay. Now don't get me wrong, everybody that knows me knows how much I love science. I love true science. And the reason is because as you study it, as you real science will always, 100% of the time, will more deeply reveal our Creator's massive intellect, his wonderful design, and he's just a master. And so it's exciting to me to read it. Real science is inspiring to me, and it's faith building, if you ask me. But much of today's science has a fundamental flaw. It's actually embedded right in the definition of science itself. This is from the Google Dictionary. Science is the intellectual and practical activity encompassing the systematic study of the structure and behavior of the physical and natural world through observation and experiment. Key word here, one of the flaws, is observation. Because all they can do is observe our present world. And they make a consistent assumption that our present world is exactly the same as it existed previous. They can't observe, they can't apply science to previous. They can't be, why? Because they can't observe it. It's a main component of what science is observable. And so they can't go back. Now, listen, there's a lot of science that can accurately deduce backwards. I'm not poo-pooing that. But there are some things that you when you make an assumption and base something on the fact that it must have been the same way then as it is now, you expose yourself to error. And it is why we need revelation sometimes, okay? That our Bible is not a science book. But there are things in that we can't tell from science because we can't observe them. They need to be revealed to us. And there's some very good scientists out there that are beginning to realize that if you base your science on revelation and you base it on a solid foundation, you get to an accurate conclusion much quicker. Or actually able to even get to an accurate one. And so as I was going through this, almost every one of these articles, these points in this other guy's article, they make this assumption that the depths of the oceans, the heights of the mountains, all of these types of measurements and things, they assume that the Earth's surface is the same as it was then. And you just don't know that. Was it identical then as it is now to base all these calculations on? Did not God say that he was going to destroy the Earth? Well, the Earth is still here. So he didn't mean it in terms of it just being gone. What was there was destroyed. It was changed. So would that not imply that there's at least a possibility, a chance, that there's things now with respect to our Earth that are not the same as they were prior to the flood? In my view, the gigantic problem with all these scientific explanations against the flood by unbelievers, and remember, listen, I was reading both sides of this stuff, okay? Because the believers, the scientists on the believer's side, they kind of have the same problem. Because neither one of them were there to observe it, right? So by definition, neither side can scientifically, you know, they can't have science in that sense on their side. That's why we need revelation. So let me give you an example of this as I was going through. It relates to this argument about the volume of water and how much water it takes to cover the Earth. We had a conversation with one of your friends about this. Now, what I'm going to say, it's a highly simplified version of both sides because I'm just trying to illustrate the how neither one can really get there. On one hand, those that reject the biblical revelation, they take the stance that they've calculated the amount of water on the earth, and there's not enough. There's just not enough to even remotely cover the mountains. They say they even know how much water there is below the earth. How, I don't know. We have ground penetrating radar. It only goes infinitesimally down into the earth. I have no clue how they think they know that. But anyway, one article even made this graphic. This, they say, that little blue ball, they say, is a sphere containing all of the earth's water, both above and below ground right now. And it's a ball that then they graphically compare to the size of the earth. So all the water on the earth is a ball that would be 860 miles in diameter. Approximately, they said, the distance between Salt Lake City and Topeka, Kansas, oddly enough. And this is according to the United States Geological Society. So it's a government agency. It's got to be right. Maybe it is. Today. Maybe it is right today. They're observing today because they're doing science. Now, if you let that water ball out, pop it, and it flows around the earth, what's it going to do? It's going to fill the oceans. 71% of the surface of our earth is water. But comparatively, it's really not, I mean, it's deep, but it's not that deep. Okay? So, just calculations, they say all that water would go into the low spots, would fill the ocean basins. It doesn't come anywhere near a mountain. Case closed, no global flood. Okay, so here comes the believer. They have two explanations. One is that, well, there was obviously more water then. So then you ask, okay, well, where'd it go? Well, they have two answers for that. One is that it went down into the deeps, the great deeps that God talked about, and that, you know, scientists, you don't know how much is down there. Okay. The other is that God caused that water to precipitate back out through our atmosphere, okay, which he could do, and it has then dispersed into the universe. Okay. I don't know. We'll just have to ask God, won't we? Don't know. Another explanation that corresponds to the water calculations is that before the flood, they like to say that the earth was pretty much flat. Now this has problems, okay? Because what they say is that the earth was pretty much flat. And if you take then that little ball, they'll even use their ball of water, and you disperse that water over the earth, that the whole earth would be covered in about 100 feet of water. And that there is enough water. But we got the mountains during the cataclysm of the flood, and the tectonic plates and all of this stuff moving around, and the mountains heaved up, and that caused a bunch of pressure, which made the seabeds sink and compact. And man, they got all this going on about this whole thing about all these major changes that happened. But then the non-believers will come back and say, well, wait a minute, guys, if that happened, you know, if you have just a little tiny earthquake out in the ocean, it creates a tsunami. It can create tsunamis that will just literally wipe out a shoreline. And so if you take and start doing math about all of these things that you say has to happen for these humongous mountain ranges and everything else to be created during this time, the amount of tsunamis and the amount of destruction of the water and the waves would just take that arc and just make toothpicks out of it. Impossible for it to survive. And even the non-believers, they will look at the Bible and say, now wait a minute, the Bible's not saying that, that the mountains were created. It's saying that the mountains were already there and were covered. And I was like, well, when did you start reading the Bible? You know, it's really kind of interesting when you go back and forth. And so at least I give them kudos for realizing the mountains are still there. But the more I read both sides, the more I realize that neither scientist on their own could account 100% for all these different variables in the account. And like I said, the non-believers, they have a problem. Because there is scientific, observable evidence right now of global flood. It exists in geology, although there's debate about it. How do we have fossils? Saltwater fish in Kansas. How do we have saltwater fish in the Rocky Mountains? It's a problem. It says, see, this is one of these pesky little problems that they have, and it's why they have to dive in and do all they can to just prove this wrong. Okay? It's difficult, without a worldwide flood having occurred, to find these things. How do you explain that? I've never heard anybody explain how you get saltwater fish in so far inland and so high. How do you do that without a, you can't. I mean, just logically, you know. We also get all sorts of information about the Grand Canyon. Oh my gosh, just on and on. The believers will cite the Grand Canyon. Proof positive that the global flood happened. It happened on this continent, and the whole Grand Canyon was carved out in, what, 14 days or something while the water was receding. The geologists will come back and they'll say, no, no, not so. There's steps in that, and there's these little, I don't know, also, I mean, they just go back and forth. You know, according to, you know, that one author, I'm not imbued with enough smarts to understand him. But I do have eyes. I've been to the Grand Canyon. Anybody else here? Have you ever been to the Grand Canyon? Any of you? Well, I have. And do you see that little bitty river down there? How small it is. I mean, it's a pretty good sized river, but by comparison, it looks pretty little. Now, I may be not imbued with scientific mind and be stupid, but I am pretty much aware that water never flows uphill. I've never seen that happen. If you take that river and you bring it up to the height of where it supposedly started cutting that millions of years ago, and you trace that back to its headwaters, the headwaters have to flow uphill to get there. Uh-oh, that's a problem. Wouldn't that give you some sort of clue that what you're observing today is not necessarily exactly what you were observing 4,000 years ago, maybe? Okay? You can't observe today the conditions that were present then. And so both scientists, they love this canyon. And both will cite that it proves their point, both for and against the flood. Another thing I found both scientists talking about and arguing about was this idea of the ark, the way it was constructed, and could it have survived this cataclysmic storm that ravaged the earth and the massive waves that obviously occurred if there was a worldwide flood. You find YouTube footage and movies like this. I don't know where my volume is. But you see what's happening here. See that? What was that depicting? It's just massive storm and these rolling waves and everything. We read the whole account. Did any of you hear anything about a storm? I didn't. They just assume that there's a storm. Okay? Why? Because when there's a lot of water now, we have a storm. And so we just assume that everything is the same today, observable as it was then. Okay? Now, the Bible says that there was rain and that the great depths were being opened up. Who is to say that there was a monstrous storm that the ark had to endure? Who's to say? The Bible doesn't. Scientists on one side say the ark can't survive this massive storm, these massive waves. And so then scientists on the other side spend massive amounts of money to try to prove otherwise. I don't know why we don't have audio. Don't need it. So they make this gigantic tank. They build a model of the ark. They weight it with what they feel like is, for the animals and the load that's on there. They put all these sensors on it. Look at the trouble that they've gone to here. I mean, it's amazing. And so they lower this thing in there, and then they have this gigantic machine that they've built to create what they say has to obviously be these huge waves, and they study this thing. It's amazing. But whoever said there was a storm? Why can't believers, these were believers, by the way, why can't they just trust that the same God that sealed the ark from the outside had the presence of mind to build the ark the way it needed to be built and provide an environment for it to survive? I don't know about you, but I've seen it rain and not storm. I mean, your nice, gentle rain comes straight down, not very often in Kansas, but it can fall straight from the sky and just rain. Whoa. Anyway, nobody said there was a storm. So, what's the point? Was there a storm? Was there not a storm? Don't know. Wasn't there. Not a scientist. Wasn't there to observe it, was I? And neither were they. And so this reading that I did, I came to the conclusion that observable science cannot prove or disprove the biblical narrative either way. It can't. It can't do it. So where's that leave us at the end of the day? Are we supposed to, as we're accused, all of us that are not imbued with enough sense to have two rational thoughts glued together, to just have blind faith? Is that what we're supposed to have? Just blind faith? No. A while back I did an entire series devoted to the science of the Bible, to taking a logical transition from how the universe was made, all of those proofs, to understanding that there had to be a creator. Then I linked to that the idea that creator must, if he created life, he has to have power over that life, right? That is the indication of God. He has to have power over life and death. Now, there was somebody, as I recall, that came to this earth and demonstrated that power, right? And that's, Yeshua, of course. And so that's where that whole series led to. And that person, if you will, God, came and he supported the biblical narrative. What we read when I started this message, that narrative, he supported that narrative of Noah's flood. His name was Yeshua, and he said this: "For as in the days before the flood, referring to the flood. They were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. Noah and the flood. And did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also shall the coming of the Son of Man be. In other words, Yeshua knew the flood occurred. And that's more than enough for me. Why? Because he's the ultimate scientist. And guess what? He was there and he observed it. And he referred to it. If I was carrying a mic, I'd drop it. Amen?
Saith the Lord.
Amen.